Bum 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 da-da-dum, da-da-dum-da-da-dee-dee-dee. Sing, 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 little buddy, sing, sing, sing it. The bird on the dum-dum-dum.
Hello, everybody. This is Teddy Johnson here.
You weren't going to become famous on radio. You weren't going to become somebody that was going to fill the Palladium. This is Radio Luxembourg, 1293 meters.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Teddy Johnson.
Well, the original introduction to radio, yes, was through my father's crystal set. Yeah, literally, yes. I think he made it himself. That's what you did in those days. And the first thing I remember, and I remember it very well, was what today they call a Royal Variety Show, which we in those days was called a command performance. We're talking about probably 1931, 1932, might have been as late as 33. And I started to listen to the first band I think I heard, being already wanting to be a professional drummer, was Marius B. Winter, who was very famous in his time. He was the original one I remember was Marius B. Winter and his orchestra, and possibly variety acts occasionally like Billy Bennett, one of the great legendary comics of the variety theatre.
If somebody in the audience will suggest a celebrity, I'll make a lightning cartoon in the short space of 2 seconds. Any suggestion?
Marius B. Winter and Jack Payne and his band. They were about the only ones until Henry Hall came along. He took the place of Jack Payne, because Jack Payne, when he left the BBC, he had very, very lucrative variety contracts. He would go to, you know, places like Newcastle and Sunderland and Empire, the Palladium, you know, and play to a lot of money. You could play to, in those days, you're talking about maybe £2,000 a week. You could mess that. I'm not saying that you would get that. Obviously, the house retains some, gives some of it to the house. Well, I was listening to programmes like that, of course, but otherwise, it was the Dance Bands. Yeah, I'm sure that was the time Jack Payne was then in residence at the BBC, and I think he used to do about 4 broadcasts a week. Very flatteringly, that was my first big-time job, was with Jack Payne and his orchestra.
Love is the sweetest thing. What else on earth could ever bring such happiness to
everything? Well, it never occurred to me that I was an aspirant to radio. I don't think I ever thought, oh, I'd love to be there saying, hello, everybody, this is Teddy Johnson here. I don't think really I had that, because I think I can say that my aspirations were broader than that, and radio didn't mean that. You weren't going to become famous on radio. You weren't going to become somebody that was going to fill the Palladium or the London Pavilion or the Empire Sunderland, Newcastle Empire. You weren't going to do it not through this thing called the wireless. That didn't come until you had the intelligence to realise what the potential was of being on the wireless. That was a completely different thing. So I got fed up with working in the West End as a drummer, even though I was earning good money of 18 quid a week, which was a lot when you consider that my father was only earning £5 a week. And I got fed up with just playing wire brush like this, very quietly. It's a good job, one of the best jobs in London, the Mayfair Hotel. But I got very bored. And, I mean, obviously I wanted to do more than be a drummer. I had aspirations to be a stand-up. Also, I had some, really, I think the best thing is to say, I wanted to be an English Bing Crosby type. one who could stand there and sing a song well, if necessary, could also tell a joke if he wanted to, you know, could also jibe away with people like Bob Hope or, you know, I do people like Morecambe and Wise or something, or other comics of our particular time, that time, people like Ted Rave, he was very popular at that time. And so I was happy to do anything, and I was very happy being a drummer at the Mayfair Hotel until unfortunately I'd got too bored, I think, and too big for my boots. I literally told the band leader to stuff the job, which I never should have done. I was totally out of order, and it's because he was paying me good money, but he was, as a band leader is entitled to do, he was wanting to dictate the way I sang. I was ad-libbing on a vocal, you know, give me 5 minutes more. I said, give me 5 minutes more, give me five, maybe 10 or something like that. I was improvising in some way or another, you know, which I was inclined to do, you know, and stick to the melody. And I just, he said that to me once too often. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you can stick the job where you, whatever you like to say, you know, he didn't deserve. It was bad of me. And I didn't regret it for the fact that I obviously lost the job. I was wanting to move on anyway. It was always just a place for me to earn money, and which I was. I was earning good money, 18 money, living at home with my parents, you know. And I think I'd managed to save about 80 quid in my bank account. And I was able to be out of work for a little while, just doing a few odd gigs that I'd collect in Archer Street before, out of the blue, a friend of mine who I'd met with Phil Green, who was a band boy of only 15 years old at the time, but he's a young guy, and he one day came up to Archer Street on a Monday, when that was the time you gathered in Archer Street, and you couldn't move in Archer Street in those days, full of musicians, Tom, and diaries, making out their diary for the gig, yeah, Thursday, fiver, yeah, 4 quid, all right, yeah, taking them down. And then because there'd be nobody in the street after that, just Mondays, full on Mondays, particularly on the Monday afternoon. And this friend of mine, he said, go along and see Frank Lee at Radio Luxembourg. The office was in Davis Street, I think, in those days. They want an announcer at Radio Luxembourg. I said, well, I've never been an announcer. He says, go along there. I said, you can do it. Okay. I was willing to do anything, you know. In hindsight, I don't know what I thought. I don't know whether I thought, my God, this is me. This is my big chance. It was just something that, aren't I lucky? I'm doing this, you know. And that's what happened. I went along and saw Mr. Frank Lee. We got on very well. But I do know it was Monday, as I say. He obviously liked what he heard and saw. He said, go around to the Harry Allen Tower. I arranged for you to go around to Harry Allen Tower's studio. He was the big guy in recorded programs in that particular day. He sort of made his name on them, doing recording programs and selling them. You know, at a commercial station, I think he sold them. He was probably the only one at the time selling them all over the world. And he said, just record something and we'll see. And he did, and I went back home after I'd done it, and I think about 5 o'clock the phone went, and it was Frank Lee. He said, yeah, he said, well, the record's okay. He said, I wonder, would you like to go over to Luxembourg and go over there for 2 or 3 days, see if you like it there, and they like you also. I had a couple of gigs on the Friday and the Saturday, but right away I said, yes, okay, certainly. I got the gigs cancelled, got somebody else to do them, put a dip in. And did I fly? No, I went by train, I think, that particular time, by boat to Ostend, and got the train from Ostend to Luxembourg. and I was met by a man who became a dear friend for the rest of our lives together until he died, sadly, Geoffrey Everett. He became head of Radio Luxembourg over here eventually. You know, he became the head chief announcer.
During my stay, there was only Teddy Johnson, Pete Murray, Peter Madron, and myself, plus the summer relief announcers.
And he was always very nice. No problem to work with, didn't instruct you as to what to do. Gave you hints if you wanted them. He was ideal. I mean, I suppose in hindsight, you could see that he realised, I think he's actually said this to me, he said, oh, well, I realised that, we'd got something in you, what you were doing, the way you were doing it was right, and nobody was telling me what to do. It was just something that was there. This was a form of entertainment, and this was the microphone, and this is what you do. And I'll never forget the joy that I found when I went to Luxembourg. There I was in a studio, there was a microphone, there were some records. Let's do a program. And I did them in a way, I know maybe this will help. There was a program in Europe called the American Forces Network. Not that I'd listened to it assiduously, because the reception wasn't that good. Some nights you would hear the American forces absolutely perfectly. Other nights all you'd hear, same as Luxembourg. Sometimes you'd hear Luxembourg perfectly. Other times all you'd hear would, nothing more than that. So it was just something that came to me. Nobody ever told me what to do.
Why don't you make a date with 208? Your friendly station entertains the nation. Hear your favorite disc jockey spin the hit tunes of the day. Top singers, bands, and funny men to chase your cares away. So join your friends and tune in, make your evenings bright and gay. 208 on the dial, make a date on the dial with 208.
I was going to a radio station which was reputed to have the strongest signal in the world, I believe. It was an old castle, evidently, a Ruritanian-type castle. Beautiful, including a moat going round the whole thing. And it was, say, nothing like you would imagine a radio station, my introduction to radio. What had I done? Had I done any radio? I think I'd done one or two things with Jack Payne up to that time. I did some broadcasts out of BBC in Birmingham that were all, and the BBC studios were all very professional and very, what shall I say, very workable. There was everything in there. When you went my first time in a BBC studio, seeing everything that was lying around, it was a mass of music stand and wires, totally uninviting for a fact that you were going to hear, this is going to be where you're great broadcasts are coming from, and you'd think what the good things you'd heard, and then it was coming from this, you know, I mean, God, this is like a warehouse, unbelievably so, you know, but that's where the lovely sounds came from.
I arrived in Luxembourg on the 20th of May, 1948. It's a date I'll always remember, apart from the fact it was a significant one in my life. But it was my sister's birthday, so I do remember the actual date well.
I mean, a lot of people probably decried Radio Luxembourg as not being like the BBC, but it was very good. They aspired to a different commercial audience because that's where the advertising was. Oh, Luxembourg has always been a great friend to me, always. I just got the records and I did them. Nobody ever said that Geoffrey Everett was the only one there who was liable. He was head of the English section and my governor. But he never, I won't say he didn't advise me, you know, why don't you try this one, try this record, but he would never order me as being in charge. He was absolutely wonderful to be with, and I have to thank him for helping to lay the foundation of, I mean, I have had a career in radio, in and out sort of thing, which is what normally you have to do in the United Kingdom. You know, I don't know if there is anybody. I think it's better these days, people, because you can get to get work in radio for a daily. You know, you can do 7 days a week. And obviously the BBC are now paying more money. So it is, yes, I've done daily radio, so I know that it's worthwhile doing daily radio.
We used to have a lot of request programmes like Music for Everyone and a programme called Irish Half Hour, which, as its name indicates, was obviously only for Irish people.
Usually it reflected the top 20. The Irish listeners, and it was strictly confined to Irish people, and they usually requested, they'd request the top 20. Or old Irish things like Galway Bay, Bing Crosby doing Galway Bay, and things like that. That was a big request, because it was a lovely record by Bing Crosby.
If you ever go across the sea to Ireland, then maybe
after closing... well, I think one night I thought, I'm doing three different programmes. I should have three different names. And that's what it was. I was Teddy Johnson, said, thank you very much. This is Teddy Johnson, say, good night, everybody. And I'll speak to you tomorrow night, I hope, usual time, 10:30 or whatever. See you here on 1,293 metres. We weren't on 208 then, 1,293 metres. And so thank you, Teddy Johnson. Good night, everybody. Night, night. Boom. This is Radio Luxembourg on 1,293. Good evening, everybody. This is E. Victor Johnson here. Or Edward V. Johnson. You know, just, I used to used to do that, you know, and then, naturally, it was, in hindsight, you know, it wasn't bad, was it, really? You don't get invention like that in radio today.
For all that's worthwhile, your radio dial is on Radio Luxembourg.
The gong was there, well, on a... like a gong pedestal, whatever you call them, and the mallet was there. You just banged it like that, and it was very resonant, you know, a sonorous boom. This is Radio Luxembourg, 1,293 metres. Bang, bang the gong again, and great. You don't hear it these days, do you?
Greetings, my little Ovaltini friends. This afternoon, I have a very special surprise for you. Many Ovaltinis...
The Top 20 started, well, in those days, it was based on the best-selling sheet music copies, a chart which was compiled by the Music Publishers Association.
Because when Geoffrey Everett, who was head of the English section, I remember we walked in the park one day in Luxembourg, and he said, they want to do a Top 20. Evidently, it was his idea, which I didn't know at the time, and obviously how it proved what an excellent one it was, you know, for international radio stations all around the world. You know. But Top 20, what's the point? I said, look, and I said, well, who's going to listen? The listeners won't listen on what to one programme with these things. We're playing these records all the week. They're not going to listen to them all in one programme. And anyhow, I went ahead and did the programme. I had to. Not that I was that, vociferous about not wanting to do it. And I was quite happy to do it, because Jeff and I got on very well indeed. I certainly respected him as a person and as a radio entertainer himself. And that was it. We got evidently tremendous figures. We had it on the Sunday night, and I don't know when it was when we started repeating it on the Thursday. The time, well, I think it was late, 11 till 12. We didn't come on air, I don't think, till 10:30. It used to depend on what the French people wanted for their transmission, because I went into a studio operated by the French people, and it was always a lady announcer there. As they vacated, there was no hiatus, it was literally to 10:30 or 11, I think, some nights. They used to be in French, and then they said their usual good nights. But we had Jeff got a signature tune, Count of Luxembourg, wasn't it? nobody interfered with me. That was the amazing thing. Nobody ever criticised what I do, what I did, whether I was violating any rules. I was quite amazed what I got away with. So I just carried on doing whatever was, being completely autonomous, really. I went out there and I didn't come home till about the, at least after 12 months. I mean, I don't think labour laws were so good then. Had I insisted, perhaps I could have insisted that I, although I very much doubt whether they would have allowed more than 1 week per year's service. Anyway, I didn't want any time to go home at all. When I gave up the job and came back to England in 1950, Luxembourg put on a concert at the Mile End Road, what's it called, the Palace? It was an entertainment hall, anyway, with Harry Gold and his Pieces of Eight. Norrie Paramore was in the band there in those days, later to become my MD and close friend. It was full of Radio Luxembourg devotees, and I was amazed at the reception I got. It was like the welcome the Beatles used to get. Quite amazing, And that would be 1950, I think, the autumn, and evidently quite a few professional people were there, and I'd done a bit of an act. Obviously, whoever was there, most of them must have seen that, hello, here's somebody, we've got to look after this guy. He's got a potential. And that's the only, I can kid myself, that I had that. And the way the audience reacted to me, it was, as I say, it was in latter years, the way the Beatles were acclaimed.
Longing, longing, longing for you. Longing, longing, lonely and blue. Daytime, nighttime, what can I do? I just keep on longing for you.
Well, I was a friend, when I say a friend, he became a friend, a producer in the number one variety producer in Scottish Home Service or Scottish Radio, whatever the BBC's title was in those days, what it still is, I'm not quite sure. And he'd seen me with Jack Benny at the Glasgow Empire. And he thought I was better than being just a solo singer. He thought I was more worthy of things. And this thing came along. It was a thriller, and very good at that, with a writer named Eddie Boyd. And the character, the chief character, was Steve Gardner. I was the base of it. Steve Gardner was the operative. He was a guy who was sort of made himself into an opera, an amateur detective. He was a Londoner who had gone up to Glasgow for some reason. I think it was ostensibly for a week's gig at the Glasgow Empire, though it wasn't actually mentioned. But it was, I think, quite something new to British radio in those days, in the way it was presented. Eddie Boyd wrote some wonderful descriptive narratives, which Eddie Fraser, he accentuated the dramatic quality of it by using the right classical music behind it. And he spent a lot of time, obviously, in putting the programmes together. But they were long stretches of narrative from Eddie Boyd, but it was beautifully written. I used to love doing them, and anybody, a lot of people who heard them, thought it was very good radio. They thought that the dramatic quality of the series, I think after only about one or two, it held up on its own, and that they didn't need the singing, and they cut the singing out. Which didn't affect me. I wasn't annoyed because it didn't take anything away from me. It just made the narrative all the more important. I was very proud of the fact that these two guys, who were producing what was something new to me in British radios, that these two creators, who I admired what they were doing, that they admired what I was doing. I felt very proud about that. To me, it's one of the proudest things I've done in my whole career. And in fact, I've had people either talk to me or write to me about hearing it. In fact, I think Doreen Wise, Ernie's wife, she said, we're on holiday in the Caribbean, and suddenly we hear your bloody voice coming over on the radio there. Unbelievable. Whether I got money or what, I don't know.
Thank you.
Oh, well, Stanley Black was the house orchestra of the BBC. I think he was a house unit, you know, doing three or four broadcasts a week. And this was one of them, a light programme. Because I was a hot record artist with EMI. I was on the best-selling single artist. And I received this offer from Stanley Black to do this series of Black Magic, which to me was no more than just a dance man programme. A very good dance man, and the best, because he had a great orchestra and he was a great pianist and MD. He was excellent to work with. It was wonderful because it was an orchestra that I admired, and I went in and either I was doing the right thing and doing it the right way, and they admired what I was... I can kid myself that's what it was, because one of the musicians in latter years had told me, reminiscing, you know, he said, God, he said, when you first started, all of us in the band, we thought you were so bloody good, we thought you were an American, you know, which was probably the highest comment, the flattering comment they could make. I didn't adopt an American accent. I was just doing what I did on, in a way, on Radio Luxembourg.
I'll never stop loving you.
Oh, well, first of all, I said, oh, I'm sorry, I don't sing with girl. I don't sing with anybody else, you know, I'm a soloist, you know. And much as I admired Pearl that then as a soloist, because I'd heard her, she was very good. She was fantastic, and she was, you know, achieving fame. She's the number one girl singer. The Melody Maker voted number one girl singer. Well, I liked her I thought she was fanciable, no doubt about that. But we both had our own liaisons. I was still in tow with a Belgian girl that I met in Luxembourg, you know. And she had somebody else, an Englishman that she was very close to. But as soon as we got with each other, I think automatically we were able to finish those other liaisons. And the rest is history.
So why should I question the stars that appear in my eyes? Of this I'm more than just sure. My love will last and endure. I'll never, no, I'll never stop loving you.
Yeah, and we were approached by a producer named Harry Carlyle, and we had to go down to... I think it was an office or a room near his office in Shepherd's Bush. The BBC had I don't know if they've still got them. I think they've got different places. Well, they've got their own building in Shepherd's Bush, haven't they? It was quite near. It was an office that the BBC people used anyway. One of the rooms with a piano, because Alan Brister was on the piano, the one who was on call, you could say, the resident house pianist for BBC programmes. And lovely, lovely guy. And anyway, it was Harry Carlyle. He was the producer of this programme. And he said, I'm trying to think, he played us, Alan Brister played us on the piano, several things which Pearl and I, we were standing by the shoulders of Alan, the pianist, and the producer was just there by the piano. And there was nothing there which we heard which excited us at all, not to want to sing. And Harry, the producer, he said, well, there's one here, he said, this is, nobody wants this. He said, everybody's heard this, nobody wants this. It's called Sing Little Birdie. So I had a look at it and said, well, try it. And put it up at the piano, and the piano pianist, Alan Brister, started to play it. Boom, 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 da 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 da. Sing, 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 little birdie, sing, sing, sing it. The bird on the da 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 da. Yeah, we like this. Yeah, we both liked it. There were smiles of recognition and joy at both Pearl and I, thank goodness. Thank goodness it was unanimous. And I think the producer was thrilled to death that he'd got rid of the stone.
Qui vient occuper les dernières places disponibles l'orchestre de Frank Purcell.
And, of course, they had in the studio when the broadcast was on, when the transmission was on, they ran a book. The crew, studio crew, ran a book. And I'm not quite sure whether Sing Little Birdie was the favourite. He said, you're the favourites, you know. And the betting was right, you know, and it walked away with it, evidently. And so I went up, and I don't know if I think I went and had a pint. It's not that I'm alcoholic, but, you know, what else can you do? So I think just for something to do, I went and had half a pint or a pint of beer in the local pub. And when I came back, I'd found out that this song, Sing Little Birdie, had won. And we'd got to appear in the final on Saturday night.
Voici Pearl Carr et Teddy Johnson.
Sing, 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 little birdie, sing, sing, sing it. There's a bird on a branch.
There's a branch on a tree.
There's a tree in the meadow, and that's where I long to be.
It was in Cannes, in France, and we'd done it. So at the time, we came out and came backstage, and it was all very cold backstage. You know, I don't mean cold weather-wise, even though it was May, I think, wasn't it? May, something. Yeah. But we found a room to have a little fag. We smoked in those days. We found a room to have a fag in. So we went and had he smoking and having a fag in this, and we couldn't hear the PA in the room and didn't want to hear the voting, you know, and it was just a blur. And I remember the studio attendant, and he poked his head through, vous gagnez, which means you are winning in French. I remembered enough of my French to know that. Not that it did anything to me. It said, oh. And that was it. And it came second, didn't it, in the end. The song that won was Ein Betje by the Dutch composers and Dutch singers.
This is the BBC Light Programme.
I was doing a week of Housewives' Choice. I don't know whether it was my first time as Housewives' Choice presenter or not. Yeah, and Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, passed off no comment, and I had to go to see Norman Newell at EMI about my recording contract and subsequent recording details, you know, what am I going to record and things like that. And I had this call at Norman's office. She said, Teddy, can you come up here immediately to the Housewives' Choice office in... It was just outside Broadcasting House somewhere. They have so many little rooms, little cubby holes poked away around Oxford Circus, you know. And she said, when I got there, she said, well, they're complaining of what you're doing this week. And I said, well, who are they? So she said, well, the people up top. Now, I still don't know to this day, actually, who they actually were. I'm trying to think, should I know? You know, what level were they? Whether they were the board... the board of the BBC. Brought out of their offices, their easy chairs, to adjudicate on Teddy Johnson. Sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? This is what it was. And I said, well, who are they? She said, well, people up top. I said, well, I don't know. When I got to them, they said, you're just being too much like you were on Luxembourg. You know? So she got the scripts for the remaining, I think it's Thursday, Friday and Saturday, and she just got a blue pencil or pencil or something and tucked that out. Like that. And anything in a colloquial fashion, like which was my style, which was, you know, what Pete Murray called the Luxembourg style, which I
which he's flattered me that I started it, which I suppose I did, you know, because I was doing it for 2 years before he went there, and he has admitted to me. He said, well, he said, I just copied you. And he said, other people when they went there followed me, copied me. So he said, we were all Teddy Johnsons, you know. And he said, it hasn't changed today, he said. The style that's on BBC and everywhere today and record programmes, he said, it's what you were on Luxembourg in all those years ago. Which I was very flattered that such a practitioner, and Pete Murray was alongside with people like David Jacobs, was one of the only people that's made a big living out of being a disc jockey in this country. There aren't many people who've been managed to do it. I didn't find it profitable. I found it much more profitable. I was going to make my money on the stage, which subsequently I have, either whether it was on my own or with Pearl. And very happy because I was always a ham. I always wanted, I don't know if you know the expression, a ham. I always wanted to perform. I was like that as a kid. And I was, my mother was a pianist and a very good pianist. She could read anything I put before her, even up to a late age. She was wonderful. And it was, I can say that, you know, that laid the foundations of my musical knowledge of a musical Teddy Johnson.
Teddy Johnson.
The BBC at that time were putting people under contract for about 3 years. People like Pete Murray, I think. I don't know if this is official. Maybe David Hamilton, I can't quite remember. And they gave me a contract. I rather think, even if I hadn't got it in writing, I rather thought they felt obligated for 3 years, because that's what they were giving at the time, if I remember rightly. And inasmuch as I turned down all other work just to do radio, I turned down stage work, which was more lucrative than the BBC work. And I think they felt obligated that they've got to give me work for 3 years. And that's what they did too. I did The Daily Show for quite a while.
Dancing in the Dark, played by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Elmer Bernstein. Dancing in the Dark, well, that was a pastime during the Second World War, wasn't it? Because of the air raids and the blackouts. Maybe dancing outside on the veranda by the light of just the moon. Perhaps dancing to Glenn Miller records, one of which would undoubtedly...
I don't think I can... There's anything more I can aspire to. I've never thought of myself as a great singer. I've always enjoyed singing. I've always enjoyed being with Pearl, of course, obviously. I can think of nothing but praise and delight and love when I speak and think of Pearl at any time. Relative to anything, whether it's Pearl as a person, Pearl as a professional, she was the ultimate. She's always been absolutely wonderful and understandable. That's the beauty of Pearl.